Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Mary Scott Boria, and she will be speaking on multiculturalism. Are we ready? So let's listen in on Mary Scott Boria.
The three model projects that have been started, one is in the Milwaukee area with the, in the Minnesota area with the Minnesota Council of Churches. One is in Nebraska with the Nebraska Synod, and another one is in New York. And there may be other smaller ones. I know he was doing some work in North Carolina.
The Nebraska one is jointly with the Chicago Metropolitan Synod and the Central State Synod,
right,
which is Kansas and Missouri.
Is that where you're from?
Yeah, we're involved. We know Joe.
So you're familiar with that. Okay. And have you been in his training?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I'm not going to do his training, but I was tempted to do pieces of it. But I'm involved in that training program and have recently joined the board, and I'm a trainer with the Crossroads Ministry. So a lot of the work that, or the work that Crossroads Ministries does, is basically anti-racism training. So a lot of my topic today and for the week is based upon looking at multiculturalism from a position of race. And so we may want to talk about some other issues, but I'm less equipped to talk about other multicultural issues, and my experience is more around race, racism, and that history. So that's what I'll focus my discussion on. I'd like for this to be very participatory. I found in putting together these one-hour scenarios, it was very difficult because the model that I'm used to working with is a much more long-term, intense model, and it's hard to break it up into little chunks. And the reason why it's hard to do that is because looking at this topic, you need to have a real comprehensive sense of how to address the issue of racism, and I think an hour does not do us justice, and I think 5 hours really doesn't do us justice. And so it's really hard for me to figure out how to take that and break it into five segments when you're not sure you're going to have the same group of people every day and they move you around, so you're in different places and you're in different time slots. So I've tried to sort of break this down. Some of this, if you're here for the week, may be very similar to a lot of the stuff that Joe Barnt does. But what I plan to do this week is to try to take some pieces of it and figure out what makes sense to really try to focus on. Today I thought we would just do pretty much an opening discussion around multiculturalism and how do you look at that through lenses of race and racism in America. And tomorrow, I thought what we would do is share some stories. Last week, we shared some stories, and actually, I think that day probably was the most enlightening, because we all have stories, and we all have experiences, and we all are in different parts of the country experiencing this issue in very different ways. Those of us in Chicago have probably a lot of experience with multiculturalism and racism, but I don't know that I think we're any more equipped to deal with it than people who are in communities where they don't have to face the issue very much every day. So I think we learn a lot from others' experiences. Wednesday, what I'll be doing is we'll be looking at how we're all created and we're all victims of racism. And this is the brown eye, blue eye experiment, which is used a lot. And then Thursday, we'll look at how stereotypes continue to follow us. And then on Friday, I experimented last Friday, and I'm going to continue that experiment this Friday by looking at Derrick Bell's theory about racism and the permanence of racism, and we have like a little role play that we'll do. So I hope that you'll come and won't be scared off if you're here. That we had a lot of fun with it last week and people really enjoyed it. Okay, so that's pretty much what I'd like to do for the week. And today I think I want to talk about culture and multiculturalism and what I think some of the issues are that we're, I think, going to face in the next 20, 30, 40 years in looking at this issue. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, we've been multicultural for, you know, 400, 500, 600 years. It's not yesterday that this country became a multicultural country. But I think it's been only in the last 10 or 15 years where there's been so much concentrated attention placed on what does that mean for America. And I think in some ways what that means is that some of our real strong historic roots are starting to be pulled up. And so it's forcing all of us to sort of look at who we are, what we were, and what we will become. And so I think, though I look at this from the lenses of race, I think America is looking at it from a much more comprehensive worldview. And I think that there are, I think our whole way of life is being sort of turned upside down. And certainly how race plays into that is an important component. What I'd like to do at the very end, I'm not sure if Joe does this in your training, but I love it, and that's sort of creating the wall of history. And one of the, you'll see here, except for that sheet of paper, there are several sheets of paper there that I left up on the board, and I see that people are coming around and adding things to it. But this is a wall of history that starts at 1492 and ends at 1994. And what we hope to do on Friday is to look at 1994 and beyond. So this goes to 1994, and what we've captured here, there are lots of different ways that it's done, but the way in which I've sort of captured it here is I'd like for people, I'll give you a few minutes at the very end, if you'd like, to add some interesting, obscure facts, situations, images that you have of any of these periods in time. And this wall here goes from 1492 to 1864. The next one is The next one should be 1865 to 1954, and then 1955 to 1974, and then 1974 to 1994. And the way in which they're broken up in time periods is somewhat of a significant sort of break. There's some logic to that. But it is a wall of history of racism and a history of resistance to racism in America. And then at the top I added knowledge of your own cultural history, because I think that weaves itself through America's history of race and race relations. And so what I'd like you to do is, when we first did this, I realized that I didn't have a lot of knowledge of history. I mean, I knew when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, I knew that. I knew about Columbus, I knew that. I knew the year I was born. But I didn't think that I knew much else. However, I think that the collective knowledge of history gives us an expansive wall. And I think there are lots of things about history that lots of things that people know that for them are very obscure. Let me give you an example. We did this wall when I was in Minnesota a couple months ago. And it's a very, if we have an opportunity to do this on Wednesday, just explore what's up there. I mean, on Friday we'll do that. About a year ago, I went to the public library in Chicago to see a movie and hear a talk. And I'd seen some clips about the movie, and it was being shown during a week in Chicago that was called Race Matters. There was a series, actually there was a month-long series of discussions around the city on race. And so I was sort of drawn to this film. And I went to the film, and as it turned it on, we got into the film, I got very emotional. And immediately what was apparent to me was that this was a film, I can't remember what the title of the film was, but this was a film about the race riots in Corbin, Kentucky in 1920. And now, some of you are a little older than me and you might remember, sort of, or at least have some closer knowledge to that time period. Well, what was so startling about this period, or at least this situation for me, is that my aunt, my mother's sister, who was now probably around 85, in her late 80s, lives in Corbin, Kentucky. And I never understood why we never, as a family, visited her in Corbin, Kentucky. I always knew that there was this dark secret about us not going to Corbin, Kentucky. And I can remember as a teenager, my sister and my mother going to Kentucky, but going to another town in Kentucky and having my aunt come from Corbin, Kentucky to this other town to visit her. And at that time, I was a very rebellious teenager, and my attitude was, I don't go nowhere that I'm not wanted. And so if I couldn't go to Corbin, Kentucky, I wasn't going anywhere near Corbin, Kentucky, but I didn't really understand why. Well, my mother is white, and my aunt obviously is white, and this is a town in that has the reputation of being one of the very few towns in America that still does not have any black population at all. And since 1920, there has not been one black person that has lived in Corbin, Kentucky. Now, you can imagine how I felt having my relative be so honored to live her life in this small town. Well, what was most painful for me was not that reality. I mean, that reality was very painful. But what was much more painful to me was the fact that I have a little cousin who is now 26 years old. She's not a little cousin anymore. She's 26 years old, whose mother is my cousin, who's the daughter of my aunt there, whose father was African-American and mother is white, who grew up in Corbin, Kentucky. And to think that this young woman spent her life in a town where she could not even affirm who she was racially was very, very painful for me. And now she's a 26-year-old woman, she lives in New York. I mean, she sort of ventured back to, they couldn't keep that from her. They couldn't keep it from her forever. I mean, I don't know what they did to raise her. I don't know what kinds of things they told her about herself. I do remember at one point when I was probably around my early 20s, speaking to my aunt on the phone and asking her if she could come and visit, because she's the same age as my oldest daughter, if she could come and visit us for a summer, and my aunt saying, don't ever ask her to come. Don't ever ask her to come to Chicago, because we don't want her to know that she's African American. And I didn't quite know what that meant, because I didn't know the story of Corbin, Kentucky, and I didn't really know the story of my aunt's life. I didn't have a context for that. I knew that it didn't fit right with me, but it was this movie. And so I put on the wall of history 1920, and as I learned more about that period of time, it was between the years of 1910 and 1920 where there were the most lynchings in the South ever. And it was also a period of time in America's history where it was the rise in the Ku Klux Klan in the South.
And in the Midwest.
And also a time period when, let's see, what was the other thing I was going to say? There were the most race riots in the country around that period of time. And in Corbin, Kentucky was a place where African Americans had been sent to work the railroads, to build the railroads during the war. And after the war, when the soldiers came back, they wanted their jobs back. And so there was a lot of animosity that was created during that period of time. And so there were race riots, and Corbin, Kentucky was one of those places where every black person was run out of town or lynched. And since then, there was never, ever a black person ever in that town, except for my little niece that grew up there. So I guess the emotion around this wall of history is that we all know something. It may not have been something that was printed, you know, in the textbooks that we grew up with, but we all know something that relates to racism. And even our own cultural history that may not or may relate to racism, but it may relate to who we are as people, that has sort of shaped America. That it's interesting to have, because we do these every time we do training, and it's so wonderful to go to a certain part of the country and you get history from that part of the country that you would never get. I mean, we did this in Chicago, and the wall of history was all about Chicago. It was as if no one had ever left Chicago. But then we went to Minnesota, and all the history there was about Minnesota. And I thought, wow, I never knew this. I would never have known this had I not had people creating these stories. That these are not the stories that you get in the textbooks, but these are the stories that people remember. that their grandparents told, and they're what has shaped America, and we just don't have that information. So I would like to stop a few minutes before we end and just have you go around and add, if you have a pen. I started doing it with a marker, but the markers were so clumsy that I didn't bring them again. A pen or a pencil to just write up there what you might recall. Okay, so today, I think what I'd like to do is just maybe quickly go around and have you say something. Say your name, and then tell me something that you, a one or two sentence about yourself culturally. So how about I start with you?
I'm Irv Goldstein from Nebraska, and I suppose I was generally culturally naive for most of my life. But I grew up, my parents were divorced before I was born, and I grew up in the home of my maternal German-speaking grandparents. And so I had that kind of diversity. My mother, when I was about 8 years old, married an Irishman, and and that was verboten in the German community, so there's that kind of tension. But I remember my mother was a very sensitive person. We traveled some between the place where she worked as a housekeeper and my grandparents' home, and she taught me that I was never to refer to the African Americans who worked on the trains as niggers. A Negro was an acceptable term at the time, but there was also a man, Native American, who sold apples and popcorn and things at the station near where my grandparents lived, and she pointed out to me that I was to teach him with respect too. So I've always considered myself very fortunate that I had a mother who had some sensitivity to other people and how they felt about their own culture. Mm-hmm. I've taken too long, but that's me.
Okay.
I'm Pearl Goldstein. I come from Lincoln, Nebraska, married to Irv. Of a complete German background too, and spoke German until I was three, I guess, and my parents spoke English too, and so I picked up the English from them, and then after that we were English speaking. Living in our rural community in central Nebraska, I didn't have much contact with other races either, except, you know, my relative too married an Irish woman, and I couldn't understand why everybody was so upset.
That's why the two of you are attracted to each other.
I guess we have the same kind of background. However, living in Lincoln and working with public schools and so on, I've been fairly heavily involved with people of other cultures and have been richly blessed by this.
There's some areas are amazing here. My name is Shirley Smith, and I currently live in Portland, Oregon. But I grew up in a small town in central Ohio, also a German family, and very culturally sheltered, naive. There still is a very strong German community in Columbus, Ohio, and it, town that I grew up in was all white middle class people. That's all there was. And never really ran into a threat until my sister married an Irishman and my grandfather went to the roof.
Talk about cultural tension.
And we thought we were getting a race here. We got two young Europeans battling against each other.
Well, I hesitate to say this. I'm Donna Samuelson from Illinois, and I'm Irish. But really didn't know anything about my cultural background or the heritages or customs that came with any of it until I was an adult. grew up in a small, well, it was small then, suburb of Chicago, and went to school with a wide variety of people. Walked to school with some friends of different color from my house on, but when we came back home, they had their own section of town, which always kind of puzzled me because we were very poor, parents were divorced, and they might have come from very healthy, strong, money, wealthy families, but they had to go to this one section and I could stay where all these fine folk lived. Now the next person who married an Irishman?
Well, I grew up in an all-white suburb of Chicago and really didn't have much contact with any people of any other race, but as I was taking Christian faith more seriously as I grew up, and especially after I decided to go to seminary, I was surprised to meet a fellow seminarian from the South who was very racist and very, much against black people. And also amused at that time when a seminarian gave me a ride to my internship assignment on the south side of Chicago, and who was very vocal against anyone who had racist feelings about black people. Well, he just thought that was terrible. But when we were driving down to the south side and we came to Pulaski Avenue, which was near my destination, I referred to it as Crawford. No, I said Pulaski, and he said, "It's Crawford, we don't name streets after Pulaski." We don't call our streets after Pulaski.
We do have a holiday now
Pulaski Avenue. Now up north in Wilmette, where I lived, it was Crawford Avenue. Outside the city limits, it was still Crawford, what it had been before. So I got acquainted with different kind of racist attitudes, prejudices, and I guess one of the good, some of the better experiences that I've had have been living in Humboldt Park or living in Germany for a year and, experiencing a culturally diverse areas.
I think Humboldt Park was a German.
Scandinavian first, then Polish. Or then, I don't know, Polish or Jewish. But when we lived there, it was mostly Hispanic, mm-hmm. and the school was 70%. But we had...
Still some Polish.
Yeah, still some Polish. We had Polish neighbors. And Filipino. Mm-hmm. And some black.
I'm Mary Lou Mayer from St. Louis, and I grew up in an all-white area of St. Louis. I didn't know blacks were not called niggers till I was about 12 years old, somebody told me. And I remember an incident when I was in high school, and when you drive the bus to go downtown, then gradually blacks would get on the bus as you got closer to downtown. This bothers me every once in a while. I feel like I'm going to confession. The bus was full of white women, and mostly women, I guess. There were some men and children on, and this black lady got on as a baby, and I knew I should get up and give her my seat, and not one person did, and we left that black lady standing with her baby, and I still feel bad about that. And sometimes you hear about people getting the hate stare. And I never experienced that until a few years ago. We were in an airport in Rome waiting for our plane to come back to the United States, and a black man was sitting next to me, and he was coughing once in a while, so I said, would you like some cough drops? And we struck up a conversation, and the plane was going to go to Chicago, and this woman, we're all sitting there waiting and tired and everything. My husband and I had a nice friendly conversation with him, and this woman it was a hate stare, and the only thing I could realize is because I was talking with a black man, but I haven't had too many experiences with other cultures.
Did I hear, were you the woman that I saw in the bookstore the other day speaking Norwegian to the woman at the bookstore?
Mm-hmm.
No. Are you Norwegian?
No. German.
Okay. That's why. That's why she wasn't.
I grew up in Milwaukee. Yeah, pretty much. I never had contact with any black in any of my schools all through high school. And it was then I moved to St. Louis when I got married. We had a little girl, and rolled down the bus going downtown one day, and she had never seen a black person. I was holding her in my lap. She had big blue eyes, and she could not take her eyes off that black person that was standing next to her. And in Milwaukee, the black had their own section, and gradually they moved out. They've now become more integrated in Milwaukee. But we never really had many problems with the black in Milwaukee, did we?
Milwaukee was
mm-hmm. It was really just no problems.
Well, I'm Ed Wiebracht, and nice to hear somebody from St. Louis. Maybe they'll verify what I have to say. I think I grew up in St. Louis. I was born and reared there. Spent about 32 or 33 years there, in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. I don't think there was any place that was more segregated than that area, even the Deep South. I think the only privilege they had, if you might remember, they could sit with a white person on the streetcars. But other than that, they were so maligned. In fact, when I was a boy, they virtually considered him the same as an animal, you might say. This upset me terrifically, and of course I had parents that did straighten me out. In other words, I could enumerate, I could almost write a book on some of this, because I did work with this later on. The fear, when we go into the Depression days, the fear on the faces of these people when you would try to locate them for work or something. I could tell any number of stories. I can just enumerate one. I had this job where, well, I'd have to go into a real discourse, but just to tell you, I had to look up these black people. The white people wouldn't work in this factory because it was so ridiculous. And I would get a sheet with the addresses, and it was all in the tenement district down, if you remember, maybe Biddle Street, in St. Louis. And I would go in there and try to locate these people and tell them, well, you're to report to work tomorrow morning at 8:00. First they tried Western Union. Well, that was out. So they gave me this car, and I did this. And that was an education that I will never forget. And I always will remember one incident. I had an address which turned out to be a vacant lot. And there were three black women with their youngsters playing around there. And I went up and excused myself and asked them if they knew who this gentleman was. I always went at it in the right way. And they looked at one another, and you know how they would talk in that time. I'd never heard of that man before, And all three of them agreed to that. And then there was this little kid on his mom's apron, she grabs it. Ain't that one of Uncle Willie's names, you know? Well, that taught me I was going about this in the wrong way. But I don't think that the things that I saw in that time I would ever want to go through again. I mean, thank the good Lord that I had parents that told me that this is all wrong. Now, we weren't in a black neighborhood. We were in St. Louis County. But during the Depression days, I got into this, and it was terrible, is all I can say.
Well, my dad's side is all German. My mother's side, probably some German, Pennsylvania, Dutch, a little French, maybe a little art, I don't know.
So his last name's Steenrod. Yeah. Sounds like my mother's configuration.
Einstar, Lindbergh, married a Swede. But really became involved with Asians in when the Vietnamese refugees came over and sponsored a family of 10. And got to go to Vietnam in 88, and so, and then their daughter lived with us for a couple of years. The family moved in to New Orleans. So I, and Helen was like our own girl. And we have gotten to travel other places, and I have the opportunity to give slideshows, and every time I talk to any school group or anyone, I tell them that mostly people are alike. I completely forget that they aren't. You know, there's so many more things that are alike in all of us. And I just want to say one little bitty story, and that was when Helm's family lived in West Point, Nebraska.
Martin Marty.
Yes, Martin Marty's a good friend. I went over, the family had not lived there very long. They had come from Vietnam. They didn't know the customs, but I was going to take two of the little girls swimming. Went over there, and they're sitting on the couch, just with their swimming suits on, but their heads down. And I said, well, are you ready to go swimming? No, they couldn't go swimming. Why? Well, because their older brother, Ben, had said they couldn't go. So I asked Ben, why can't they go swimming? Ben says, because they would get dark like Cambodians. See, they had, you know, differences too. And I said, Ben, nobody even knows what a Cambodian looks like in West Point, Nebraska. They couldn't go that day, but later on they got to go. But I mean, it opened my eyes in that all of us have our preconceived notions about other countries or other. And we've been working with Hispanics.
Yes, and I grew up in a small town in eastern Colorado. My name is Dick Lindbergh, and was a Swedish father and a kind of a British a mother. And anyway, there were no people of any diverse color or race, and we've lived mostly in small towns in eastern Colorado and now in Nebraska most of our married life. And but in the recent time, in the last couple, 3 years, we live in eastern Nebraska where meatpacking is a big thing, and the meatpacking industry has changed a lot. And now there are quite a few Hispanics that are filling those roles because the wage scale has gone down and the job has got tougher. And so the meatpacking companies have found Hispanics to fill those roles, and they kind of from Mexico, and they don't speak English, so a lot of them don't anyway, very few of them do. So anyway, and I've gotten a little bit involved with a young man who was a high school boy who was the only Hispanic boy in high school. There were quite a few Hispanic children in the lower grades, but he was by himself. So I got involved with that family, and that's been rewarding but interesting.
And now Elliot has his driver's license, thanks.
I'm Don, Dick's brother, but I live in Quincy, Washington. We have quite a few, about a fourth of our population is Hispanic or Latino. I guess you call it Latino, we call it Hispanic. I don't know why, that's just the way it is. But we get along reasonably well with them. There's no racial tension to speak of. We've been working quite heavily on diversity. I've been to a diversity conference with the Red Cross, and the city council, the city of Quincy sponsored a diversity conference, and now they have a diversity council in the city that's working to try to improve relations, and it's an effort being undertaken, which is good. I'll let people in the back row take it over.
My name is Yoshi. I'm from Japan. I'm sorry, it's hard to speak English, so I can't say hi.
Welcome.
Look, okay. I couldn't, where did she come from?
Japan.
Japan?
Mm-hmm. Where in Japan?
Osaka.
Oh,
we had several at Midland College in Fremont were from Osaka.
My name is Sherry Gilbert, and right now I live in River Falls, Wisconsin, which is just across the St. Clair River from St. Paul, Minnesota. I grew up in northern Minnesota, north of Moorhead, on a small farm. And my first experiences with people that were not either German or Norwegian, I'm half German and half Norwegian, were when we would go to the lakes in the summer and go fishing, and sometimes cabins and things were left untended or things had been taken or stolen. My dad always concluded that the Indians had gotten in and ransacked something, and so he would curse the Indians. I just thought these folks must be some frightful, terrible, awful people if that's all they did was to make a mess out of other people's things all day. And then when I was in seventh grade, a man came to Halsted, which is just west of where my parents' farm is, and he came from Bolivia to be the pastor of the Hispanic people that would come and tend the sugar beets and those crops up in that area. And we, in my small rural congregation at that point, were without a pastor, and so he consented graciously to be the pastor in this German Scandinavian community. And I thought it was quite fascinating, and I look at it still on my confirmation picture. There are three of us because it was a small, small congregation, 11 pews. And here's Julio Lozo, my confirming pastor, and these three German Scandinavian kids. And I think I'm still, or even just now, getting in touch with how wonderful that was for me as a youngster to have that experience, that this was a person of integrity, that this man was my pastor, and that he confirmed me, which is a real big landmark in a person's life. And now I have become a member of a family of color. We've adopted our two children. Elizabeth is also Scandinavian and German. Aaron was born in Taejeon City, which is near Seoul, Korea. And so I think having that experience as a young person has given me permission that that can be my family, and that that's, it was a wonderful thing to have as a child.
My name is Lisa Barat. I come from Humboldt County in California. Cultural diversity wasn't even introduced to me until I met my husband. My mother is Danish, my father was Norwegian, and I married a Catholic Portuguese. 5% Portuguese. That's my cultural diversity. My older sister married a Portuguese. One of my younger sisters married an Indian. And that's the only diversity I've ever, I mean, it's smooth and everything, but I can think of three colored people in town I've been born and raised in. And so I've never really experienced any diversities at all in culture. So until I move out in Humboldt County, which is kind of odd because you're talking about a town called Humboldt or an area.
It's a community.
A community that is very diverse. I live in a whole county that just does not have any cultural diversity.
I'm Jenny. I'm from a suburb right outside of Boston, which is
Somerville?
Arlington.
Oh, actually. I was in Boston for the very first time a couple of months ago. Yeah. In Somerville.
Right outside. Well, Boston is a very racist city, but in terms of growing up, my neighborhood that I grew up in when I was younger was kind of a working class neighborhood. So, you know, we had fairly diversity. Albanian, Muslim family next door, Greek family up the street, Italian family across the street. I mean, that kind of thing. And so, to me, it didn't really make a difference. You know, these were my friends. These were the neighborhood kids. We had a huge, you know, there were like 10, 15 of us stomping around the street, and it was fine. And it wasn't until I was going to junior high and high school that I started to understand some of the subtle stereotypes and racism of Irish Catholic suburb that started to really annoy me, and I started to realize that my parents, well, my mother more than my father, for all their talk of peace and justice and understanding, you know, we're holding these, you know, these understandings of people that just weren't true, sort of basing it supposedly on education or something, but really kind of overlooking the contributions that people of other cultures really contribute to you and to your life and that you give to each other, just really overlooking that. So I think now that I'm doing the college thing and starting to travel, I mean, I'm all the way across the country now, I really feel like I'm free to start to enter in into experiencing other cultures without that sort of hesitancy of, you know, well, mom and dad aren't gonna be too thrilled about this. I feel a lot more freedom to live out more what I believe and what I want to sort of experience and explore. So it's been good for me.
Well, there's a lot of, I heard lots of different themes. And let me just point out a couple that I heard. That there are still places, there's still some places where we don't experience diversity. You pointed that out in your own community, there are places. That's an ever-growing, that won't be a reality in the future. And that those places won't stay all what they are in the future. I heard one person say that they were white middle class, and I want to talk a little bit about that. Many of you talked about having some little bits of your experience as children, experiencing others, or experiencing the stereotypes, and then experiencing the reality later in life. And all of you probably realize that your children have a different reality, and that your children and your grandchildren will have an even more different reality. However, none of you answered the question. And I'm interested in having some discussion about why that was. What I asked you to do, and some of you answered it somewhat, but then you went in another direction. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because that's a little bit of my own premise about where do we go multiculturally. And that was, no one talked about who they were. You talked a little bit, you might have said you were German or Irish, or you had a little bit of this, your background. But then you talked about your experiences with the other. And none of you really talked about who are you culturally. Why do you think that happened? Any thoughts?
Well, I think for me, I grew up, I would think I was 7 when World War II started, maybe. And it was not popular to be German. I think they ran out the person in town that had the dime store. They said he was working with the Germans, or maybe he was having contact, you know. And so I think maybe a lot of German Lutherans, that's when they quit preaching in German. And so maybe Are you saying World War II?
World War One.
World War II. Well, World War One, they were also, but both of those, there was still some people, there were still some sermons being given in German in World War II, in West Point. We weren't there at that time, but I know I did the history part.
Was the Dame Stewart run out of town?
The man left town because they said he was having dealings with, and he was German background, but I mean, I guess I think it wasn't popular, so I didn't, my grandma told me a few German words, but I think if I had lived in a time when it wasn't so unpopular, I might have known a little more about my culture.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's maybe something we don't do enough, so that it isn't familiar. Like, if I were to describe what it is that I do, or who I am in regards to relationships with my family or community, I could maybe say some things about that, but I'm not all that familiar with, mm-hmm. with who I am as a German, Scandinavian person, and what does that mean? How is that reflected in who I am? I'm not that familiar with talking about that.
I think one of the reasons, in my case, I'm first generation American, and out of eight kids, none of us speak neither Norwegian or Danish, because both my parents felt that when they came, they were like 18, 20 years old, they were in America now, they were going to be Americans, they were going to speak English, and they weren't going to teach their kids another language. Or I know my relatives, because most of them are still in Scandinavia, so I know my background, but I was raised to be an American, and both my parents knew the history of America better than I know it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why, as far as culturally speaking about myself, I just think of myself as an American.
I think that I have a theory that runs along those same general lines. It seems to me that we have been conditioned, socialized in this country, to think that we're all Americans. I mean, I have no problem with that on the surface, but whenever in a public forum where people come together without regard to what their political or educational backgrounds and so on might be, the theme is always that we're all Americans. And the history that we've been taught denigrates the role of Native Americans in helping us. What we talk about is the Indian Wars and things of that kind. And most of the time, the Indians have been the heavies. Never mind that quite often we provoked them into warfare by seizing lands that they had entitled to think was their own. But I notice now we've had a law in the books on the Nebraska books for several years that multiculturalism must be taught in public school, and school boards all over the state are not all of them, but many of them are upset, and school board members, we're all American. Let's just do that and not discuss who we are culturally, because that becomes a divisive factor. So I think that the way we've taught our history, the way the media has handled cultural backgrounds and so on, has been such as to erase those cultural backgrounds and to bring us into being as though we didn't have any history.
Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to be an American? I mean, I'm not sure what that means.
No. Culture. I feel like I don't have a culture, and so often I've been kind of like ashamed of the fact that I grew up in an Irish Catholic suburb. I mean, I'm not Irish and I'm not Catholic, so even then I was an outsider, but I still didn't feel like I had anything. And to grow up in the neighborhood I grew up in, where they have, the families are large families and they get them together, and they have specific things that they do, or they go to Greek Orthodox Church, or they are Muslim at the time, that sort of thing, where they have specific things.
that looked like, wow, that's exciting, that's culture, that would be really neat. I don't have that. I'm just, you know, WASPy American. I don't know about that.
I think that's real interesting. I think that we are a people today that are less ritual and less into tradition than we were in the past. And I think I would agree, you know, that we don't do, I don't get together with, you know, grandma and aunts and uncles and stuff because we don't live a half hour from them like I did when in my growing up. Everyone kind of stayed around then. And now most of us are 8 or 10 hours away. It's a different lifestyle.
I think for me, because I knew I had a grandfather that talked funny. And I think that's the only thing about my background I grew up knowing. Otherwise, nothing made a difference. We had no traditions, no foods, anything. But I think culturally for me, the impact was more on economics than anything. Because in that day, I could live in a neighborhood where there was a wide variety of people economically. And today, you look at your suburbs, and unless this house costs you this much money, you can't live there. Then you're relegated to somewhere else. So that there was hope in my upbringing that one day, you know, I didn't have to stay where I was. There was hope for other achievement. But other than that, culturally, I have no connection.
So culture of achievement?
Well, there was hope for something better. You know, I was the poor kid on the block, but my friends were not, so there was some hope. But I think that when we lived in Humboldt Park, I would look at the people there who I knew were trapped and could not get out. Economically or otherwise.
Did you have your hand?
Yeah, and I don't really know how to get at this. Obviously, the people in this room are interested in people being treated equally and cultures that have not been treated equally, and so we're all coming from the same thing. I worked in the church when we were putting it together, as some of you have, from the three synods, and one of the things that we said, and said it constitutionally, that we would broaden the Lutheran church from Germans and Norwegians, and so we have tried so hard to do this, and in the synods we have all the cultural committees, and when our first committee was elected and it met the first time, two people dropped out immediately because they said, well, I thought we were going to talk about the Lutheran cultures. I thought we were going to emphasize Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, and German. And we're, you know, and so I think in the thing that has come about is we have tried very hard to learn about other cultures and that we want to be inclusive, and I think, you know, talk about Nebraska, and you are our pastor in West Point, Nebraska, aren't you?
No.
We're Missouri Synod.
You're Missouri Synod. Yeah. Okay, well, I've seen you at events.
And we went to the ELCA church in Tanzania.
You are not unfamiliar to me. And that we have tried so hard to involve people from other cultures that maybe we have played down our own. But I don't know if this is right either. I don't know.
An interesting thing, we did, I think maybe we're trying to get our German heritage started again in West Point, which is a very German town, and I was on that committee. We had a couple of successful German fests. And when we were looking for recipes and things, it was funny because what we have always been using, what I grew up with and what the people in West Point, it was the German, I looked in the German cookbook, it was the German recipes, it was the German foods that we were doing. So we weren't realizing that wherever we were in the United States, we were still like West Point's very German community, and Oakland is just 12 miles away, it's very Swedish. And we grew up thinking we were American, and we are American, but we are very much tampered by what our ancestors were. So I don't think that we're just generic.
Mm-hmm. I think there's another side to that coin. Our congregation in Moline, Illinois, was the mother church of 11 or 12 Swedish congregations, and they are Swedish. I mean, they live Swedish. And a lot of Hispanic people around the church, but they are Swedish. And it's better if you come and visit if you're Swedish.
Well,
there's something, though, that I think that unfortunately we always sort of look at these questions as sort of extremes, and there's something wrong with, you know, we don't want to honor our culture because we don't want to be ethnocentric. I mean, we want to be multicultural, and we don't want to just sort of be stuck in our stuff. But what does it mean to be American? And I think you talked about wanting a better life. And so sort of taking on an American identity, which is the language and a lifestyle. And I'm still trying to get a hold of what it means to sort of be American, other than sort of the constitutional rights that we all have. What essence is there in being American? And it seems like to me that a lot of European cultures gave up a European culture to become American, and the only thing that we've been able to identify is prosperity. Prosperity, and that's economics more so than it is richness of life. It's more richness of possessions.
Yes,
I'm intrigued by your question and the way you're dealing with it. I think the term is almost impossible to define. I think there is a generalized kind of meaning that maybe says, yeah, we're going to have a better life than we had in the old country. But I think it's that if you're going to be an American, to most people, you have to be European American.
Yeah.
I don't think you can be African American. Hispanic Americans,
or even Native Americans.
African Native American. we somehow feel that for people of cultures that come other from someplace other than Great Britain and Europe, have to assimilate themselves into our culture. Just one quick illustration. I had a colleague a number of years ago who was talking about the fact that he was free of racism and so on, and he used as an example the fact that he was good friends with and played poker with Joe Aguilar all the time, and somebody asked him, well, doesn't that bother you? His response was, Joe's as white as I am. And I think that captures the feeling of a lot of people.
So for Europeans, it was easy, though, you know, obviously there's some subtleties. I mean, my mother's German, you know, she's a big woman, you know, she's hardly, you know, she's very different than sort of another European who's a much smaller frame, you know. I mean, you could probably look at her and say, oh, I could say you're probably from one of these three or four different places in Europe. But it's easier to hide behind sort of, or to take on an American identity when you're a white person. When you're a person of color, it's not so easy to do that. I mean, you're automatically labeled.
Don't you think that World War II did much to break down all this segment of nationalities and so forth? Before that, we had the Great Depression. People were clannish in all these different parts of the country. Then we had 17 million GIs, and they traveled throughout the 48 states, and then of course in Europe and the others. They came home and they had a completely different outlook on life and so forth than when we first went in. And I believe it was, you had a terrific mixture of all the different nationalities, you know, the melting pot of America. They all got together. we made fun of one another and so forth, but I think we knocked down a big barrier. We come home, and I always said the world was never the same after World War II. And I think probably that may have been where we
now, was that change. Among European countries, or was that among races?
Well, yeah, here, we had 17 million men put in uniform, you know. They were trained here, they went through virtually all the states, they were shipped to different places, and when you went to a different segment of the country that you were not used to, I mean, your speech alone betrayed you, you know. Of course, we learned to get along with one another that way. Before that, if you went to New York, well, they could immediately tell a Midwesterner or by your speech and so forth. But that seemed to all break down in those, how many years the war went on, I don't know. But these men traveling throughout the country and mixing in with all these different elements of different nationalities, I think that was a big thing to break down many of the barriers.
I would say that probably, ethnically, that's probably true. Racially, I don't know that that's
no.
true.
Yeah,
I think that's
well, racially,
as far as the black man was concerned, no, that came later. I mean, because they were maltreated, I would say, in World War II. They were, from what I saw.
And I think even now, we have, I mean, you know, obviously I'm African-American, that's the world view that I come with. But now we also have Asian Americans, we have Arab Americans. I mean, we have the world in America.